That, I think, is all I need to say on those things. Let's get stuck in to what we're thinking about today. We're asking the question, how can we hashtag be kind, Christianity and compassion? And I want, as we start, you to imagine a UN Council debate. I want you to imagine that you put you kind of in the room as the UN Council meets, and if you've seen any pictures of that, that's kind of representatives from every country sitting there, and they've got headsets on, so things can be kind of simultaneously translated into whatever language they speak. This particular debate, back in 2015, was a debate on children and armed conflict, and how it is that the UN can advocate for stopping children both being harmed in armed conflict, but also used in armed conflict as kind of mini-soldiers. The British ambassador to the UN at that time, a guy called Matthew Rycroft, who's now the most permanent civil servant in, or the most senior civil servant in the Home Office, he stood up on behalf of Britain, and he gave his impassioned speech about this, and this is how he closed. Let me close with a final point. How a society treats its most vulnerable, whether children, the infirm, or the elderly, is always a measure of its humanity. I imagine at that point, every single one of us, maybe not physically, but mentally, is nodding our heads. The measure of a society, the measure of the humanity of a society, is how it treats its most vulnerable. A good society, says Matthew Rycroft, is a society that looks at the vulnerable and the weak and moves towards them and cares for them. And the question is, where has that thinking come from? I imagine if you gave that quote to any of your friends, they would pretty much word for word agree with it. Most people we rub shoulders with will nod when they say that a society that is functioning well can be judged by how it's treating those who are most in need of help. And the question is, how did we come to that assumption? Because you could argue that societies of the past, ancient Rome, ancient Greece, and others, were compassionless societies. Let's talk about ancient Rome. We've done that a few times in the series. That won't happen every week, but it's helpful because it's the kind of last pre-Christian society in the West. In ancient Rome, a practice called exposure was pretty common. If you don't know what exposure is, it is horrendous. There's no other way of describing it. It sounds like a kind of quite, you know, inoffensive word until what you realize is what that means is they would take children that they didn't want, and they would expose them to the elements, starvation, wild animals. They would basically go and leave children they didn't want on rubbish tips and leave them to die. That was a very common practice in the ancient world. And it is appalling. And if you think that, okay, that sure, that might have happened, but maybe that's quite a minority thing, that wasn't really that common. The first ever kind of treatise on gynecology that was ever written, so gynecology is kind of medicine of pregnancies and births and those kind of things. The first ever treatise of that was ever written included a section called How to Recognize the Newborn That Is Worth Rearing. Stop and think about that for a moment. That means those who were thinking deeply about those things wanted to help people to understand which babies are worth keeping and which babies are worth dumping on a rubbish heap. That was the Roman world. And it's not just that that was kind of true at an individual level, that maybe some individuals took that approach. No, it was argued for by the state at large. Here is a quote from Plato, secondhand, because I don't read Plato. This is what Plato has to say. So Plato, Greek philosopher. This is how Plato argues the state should function. He says that the state will provide treatment for those of its citizens whose physical and psychological constitution is good. So cares for those whose psychological condition is good. As for the others, and then we're onto the screen, it will leave the unhealthy to die, and those whose psychological condition is incurably corrupt, it will put to death. That seems to be the best thing for both the individual sufferer and for the society. That is what people used to think. They used to think that when you see someone who is kind of chronically unhealthy, someone who is mentally ill to the point that they can't be fixed, the kind thing to do is to put them out of their misery. It is to put them to death. That is the world into which Jesus stepped. That is the pre-Christian world. Some people will say we now live in a post-Christian world, and there's some helpfulness to that language, but we're definitely not fully post-Christian because we see we care about things like compassion. But there are some thinkers who really take the post-Christian idea and run it through to its logical conclusions. I talked to you about a guy called Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche is a kind of 19th century German philosopher. Why he's really helpful is because basically what he does is he says, Christianity is bad, and Christianity has kind of ruined the way humans think and has basically suppressed our natural instincts in unhelpful ways. And so we need to get rid of Christianity, but he takes that to its logical conclusions. So if you want to know what a world without Christianity is like, listen to what Nietzsche has to say. Here's what Nietzsche has to say. Pity, read compassion, on the whole, thwarts the law of evolution, which is the law of nature. Do you see what he's saying? He's saying, if we live in a world where everything is solely evolutionary and there is nothing more than matter, and that is all there is, compassion basically ruins it. Because if natural selection is the survival of the fittest, every time we stop the non-fittest from dying, we are undermining the evolutionary process. We are basically stopping humanity progressing properly because we're letting those who should be killed live. He says, if you don't think Christianly, and you just think about evolution, and you just think that that is the entirety of the world we live in and how everything is made, we should get rid of those who need help, because they are not the fittest, they don't deserve to survive. And another point, he talks about what philanthropy is. Philanthropy, for those who don't know what that word means, is kind of a love of people. It's thinking about what is the best thing to do for our society. So we talk about philanthropists as like people like Bill Gates who give loads of money to charity and things like that. Nietzsche says, true philanthropy is letting the weak and the ill-constituted perish and helping them to do so. Because he says, if you really love the human species, the best way to serve the human species is to help get rid of its weaker elements. That is abhorrent, but that is logical. You can criticize Nietzsche for lots of things. One thing you'd really struggle to criticize him for is his consistency. He takes a world without God, he runs it through, and he gets to logical endpoints. If there is no God, and everything is just bound up in a system that is solely evolutionary, there is no reason to help the weak. Because survival of the fittest means sacrificing the weak. For the fittest to survive, the weak needs to die. If you have an evolutionary system, that is all you have. Because the weak are just taking up valuable resources. And so they shouldn't be helped. Selection is natural. And so, if we don't believe in natural selection as the sole thing by which we should make all of our moral decisions, we believe in something above the natural. Does that make sense? That if natural selection is kind of here on the natural, the minute we do something that isn't in line with that, we are doing something above the natural. We are doing something that cuts against the natural. Which means, and they probably won't like it if you say it like this to them, every single one of your friends believes in the supernatural. Because they believe in compassion. If they didn't believe in compassion, that would be truly natural. But they do. Because we all do. Because we think things like this are abhorrent. They're ugly. They're disgusting. But that is a consistent view without God. If it's just selection, we should get rid of the weakest. But compassion says exactly the opposite. Because there is at the center of the universe, not a law of selection as the ultimate thing. Instead, there is a God of compassion as the ultimate being. The Old Testament speaks a lot about God's character, and the phrase that comes up again and again and again is that God is compassionate and gracious, gracious and compassionate. We pop those verses up on the screen. There are just a handful of some of the places that those words come up. Exodus 34 is God reveals himself. 2 Chronicles 13, Nehemiah 9, through the Psalms, into the prophets. Time and time again, as God tells us what he's like, he tells us he is a God who is compassionate and gracious. In many ways, that's the defining thing about God's character. He is a God who is compassionate and gracious. At the center of the universe is not a kind of impersonal principle that says get rid of the weak. There is a God who cares about the weak. There is a God who is full of compassion. I found this quote from a guy called Kelly Capick really helpful. If you want to know where God's heart goes, follow the weakness, follow the need, follow the cries. If you want to know where God's heart goes, follow the weakness, follow the need, follow the cries. At the center of the universe is not an impersonal principle. It is a God of compassion. A God who comes down to those who feel down. A God who reaches out to those who feel on the outside. That is the God that sits at the heart of the universe. And that is the God who became flesh. As Jesus walked around on this earth, the emotion that the gospel writers attribute to him the most is compassion. Time and time again, Jesus sees people and he has compassion on them. He sees the crowd who are lost like sheep without a shepherd, and he has compassion on them. He sees a woman grieving, a widow grieving her son who's just died, and he has compassion and he heals. He sees people hungry, and so he has compassion and feeds them. He sees people who are heading in the wrong direction. He has compassion and he teaches them. Time and time again, Jesus is described as having compassion on people. Jesus' miracles are never purely acts of compassion, and there's loads we can learn from them. They're meant to teach us about who he is. But as we do that, we need to never lose sight of the fact that they are acts of compassion. That Jesus wasn't cold and calculating, going, well, I need to heal this person because I need to prove a point about who I am. No, he also has deep compassion when he sees need. The word for compassion that we have in our New Testaments is a kind of word that talks about the guts. You know, when you feel something really deeply, you don't feel it here, you feel it here, right? That is how Jesus feels when he sees need. When Jesus sees need, he feels it deeply. And he wants to meet that need. Dane Ortlund, in his book, Gentle and Lowly, speaking of Jesus, he says this: if compassion clothed itself in a human body and went walking around this earth, what would it look like? We don't have to wonder. Jesus, as he walked on this earth, is compassion clothed in a human body. If you care about compassion, there is someone who walked on this earth who cared about it more and who lived it out perfectly. And his name was Jesus. At the center of the universe is not an impersonal principle. It is a compassionate God who in compassion sent his compassionate son into the world, who had compassion on those he saw, and who taught people who followed in his footsteps to have compassion. The most famous time he does that is in the story of the Great Samaritan, and Alita's going to come and read that for us to help us think about how this has impacted us and how we should live.
So the reading is from Luke 10, starting at verse 25. If you've got a red church Bible, it's on page 1041. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "What is written in the law?" he replied. "How do you read it?" He answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." "You have answered correctly," Jesus replied. "Do this and you will live." He wanted to justify himself. So he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" In reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. 'Look after him,' he said, 'and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have.' Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" The expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise."
Great. That's one of the most famous stories Jesus ever told, isn't it? It's a story that means the phrase "a good Samaritan" is embedded into the English language. It's a phrase we use. There's a well-known charity called the Samaritans based on this passage. Let's just think briefly about that story for a few moments. We know the story, but there's a man who's left half dead on the side of the road by robbers. The priest sees and avoids him. The Levite sees and avoids him. Those from the religious establishment see need and get out of the way. But a Samaritan, the outsider, the one you wouldn't expect to be the hero of the story, he sees need and he moves towards need. And he moves towards it at personal cost. He bandages his wounds, almost certainly with his own clothing. He pours on oil and wine, that's his own possessions. He puts the man on his own donkey, he takes him to an inn, he takes care of him, and he pays the cost. Here is someone who sees need, and rather than crossing to the other side, rather than ignoring it, moves towards the need, and at personal cost is willing to meet the need. And before we get to verse 37, where Jesus says, "Go and do likewise," I think it's helpful to remember who, first and foremost, we actually are in this story. Because who is the one who truly comes from outside the religious establishment? Who is the one who you weren't expecting to be the hero of the story? Who is the one who, at great personal cost, helps those in need? It's Jesus, isn't it? Jesus is the perfect good Samaritan. We need to remember that first and foremost, we are those who have been loved. We are those who were in need, who were helpless and stranded. And Jesus came to rescue us. The heart of Luke's gospel comes in chapter 19 as Jesus says, "The Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." That is us. And here the Samaritan is a figure of the one who came to seek and to save. There's a phrase that does the rounds: hurt people hurt people. You heard that? People who are themselves hurt hurt others. The flip side of that: loved people love people. As we ourselves see that Jesus has met us in our need, as we ourselves see that we were stranded and helpless without him, That is the motivation to verse 37, go and do likewise. In the death of Jesus, we see compassion perfectly. We see the strong Jesus. He doesn't avoid the weak. He becomes the weak. He doesn't decide not to dirty his hands with those in need. His body is broken for those in need. He willingly bears the cost. He becomes weak to save the weak. At the center of the universe is not an impersonal principle of selection. It is a God of compassion. And the compassionate God calls his people to be a compassionate church. One of the things that marked out the early church was the way it showed compassion. Remember the society it found itself in. A society that was willing to dispose of those who it didn't see as up to scratch. What did the early church do in response to that? Well, there's stories of early Christians scouring the rubbish dumps to try and find babies to rescue, to take in, and to care for. By the 4th century, Christianity was fairly well spread within the empire. And the emperor of the time, a guy called Emperor Julian, he said this. He said, Christianity has been specially advanced through the loving service rendered to strangers. He says, it is a scandal that there is not a single Jew, read Christian, who is a beggar, and that the godless Galileans, again, read Christian, care not only for their own poor, but for ours as well. While those who belong to us look in vain for the help that we should render them. See, a few centuries on, Christianity had taken enough of a hold in the society that even those who weren't Christian saw that caring for the weak was a good thing to do. That was a fundamental change between the first century when this was written. But here, someone who recognizes that it is important to care for the weak sees the church shaming society at large, caring not just for its own, but also caring for others in need. Not sticking to its tribe and thinking solely, how do we help our people? But seeing need and meeting need. That is what the early church did again and again and again. And throughout history, the church has been part of some of the most compassionate movements. That is not to say the church has been perfect. Please don't hear me saying that. We've made mistakes. We've done things wrong along the way. But as you look back at the heart of many of the most compassionate advances in our societies, the church sits at the heart of them. Hospitals grew out of the church. Orphanages grew out of churches. Churches time and time again saw need and they tried to meet need. Because those who worship a compassionate God are called to be a compassionate church. We're going to split into discussion groups now. Here's a question to discuss. In what ways do we see this kind of compassion already in our life together? Where do we do that well? Both corporately, so us kind of as one body, but also individually as Christians. Where do we see that kind of compassion at work? Discuss that for 5 minutes or so. Great. Why don't we have a couple of comments, a couple of bits of feedback? What kind of things were you discussing in answer to that question? You don't have to put your hand up, it's not school. So that's when you put three teachers together, they're like, do we need to put a hand up? Yeah. Well, another group maybe, one more comment, we'll dive back and stuff. Exactly. And that is because we live in a culture that is downstream of this stuff, that shockingly there was no safeguarding in the first century. Because people didn't see giving a voice to the voiceless as important. But now they do. There's loads of other ways I see that we embody this as a church. It's the way a lot of you move towards others in need, the way that others of you will have benefited from people really caring for you in your times of need. This is an opportunity to plug the Fellowship Fund. You don't get to do that very often. There are those who are financially in need in the church who want to seek to meet those needs. If that's you, if you are struggling financially, please tell us. We want to be those who help with that. In many ways, I hope as a church we are compassionate, and I see a lot of that. We thought about a compassionate church in the light of a compassionate God. Let's move on to think about a compassionate society. Because there are lots of things about our society that we can praise. I mean, safeguarding being an example, but that's seen as important. We value compassion so much that nearly everyone in this room pays quite a lot of money for it. If you are a UK taxpayer, you are paying an awful lot of money towards compassionate causes. If you're a tax nerd like me, what you do, let's get that one out of the way. What you would do with your free time is go and look at your annual tax summary. Has anyone ever done this?
Shock and horror.
Yeah. If you go to your annual tax summary, it tells you not only how much tax you've paid, it also tells you where that money has gone. So every year, the government, as part of their transparency, tells you how they've spent your money. Quite a good thing, isn't it? It tells you that both as a percentage of the tax you've paid and as a raw amount. Last tax year, if you're a taxpayer, about 20% of your tax money went on the NHS. That is 20% of the money you gave in tax went towards caring for the sick. Another 20% of your money went on welfare, caring for those who are on low incomes or physically unable to work or have a numerous other number of difficulties. Another 10% went on the state pension, helping those who are no longer able to work to afford to live and eat. This is not the place to get into a debate about how big the state should be and how much money we should give in tax and how that should be spent and all those kind of things. But the headline is, that is at least, or it's about 50%, and there's some other bits you can add in as well to make it a bit more, 50% of the money that you pay in tax every single year is towards compassionate causes. Slight changes how you view how much tax you pay, doesn't it? That is because we live in a society that cares about this kind of stuff. There is a lot in our society that as we look, we can praise the way they are compassionate towards those in need because they are downstream of Jesus and his teaching. In many ways, some of those, the welfare state is an outgrowth of the Good Samaritan principle. A compassionate God cares about people and people made in his image, in the light of Jesus' teaching, help those who are in need. You can see that our society cares about compassion because of where we put our tax money. You can see that our society cares about compassion because of how many people give of themselves to care for others in need. There are some in this room who in paid ways or in unpaid ways give an awful lot of your time towards caring for those who are ill or unable to care for themselves. So that might be in your professional life. That might be in your free time. It might be family. It might be friends. It might be church family. But that is something that a lot of us do, and not just us, but the society at large. You will almost all know people who give of a lot of their time to care for other people. We can praise that in our society. There are things in our society that are praiseworthy. We've talked about charities. There are so many charities who in so many ways are seeking to help those in need, and we can praise those things. There is, however, stuff within our society that we must challenge. Because one of the tragedies with this idea of compassion is how it's been distorted in some ways. We don't talk about abortion or euthanasia very often, but I think we need to every now and then. Because one of the things is that both of those are argued for by many people using a compassion argument. You notice that? So take them in turn, take euthanasia first. It is compassionate to stop people suffering. Therefore, the compassionate thing to do is to allow them to die. And not just allow them to die, but to actively help them to die. People are arguing for that, not based on the fact that that person doesn't deserve to live, more on grounds of compassion, supposed compassion. Or you see it at the other end of life, on questions of abortion. And so the argument goes, well, it's unfair to bring a baby into the world who isn't wanted. It's not compassionate to bring a baby into the world when there's no one to care for them. It's not compassionate to force a woman to go through what is quite painful labor when she doesn't want the baby at the end of it anyway. It's not compassionate to bring a baby into the world if that woman doesn't have sufficient support around her, and so I guess we should just kill the child. A lot of the things in our society that are least compassionate, because look at who's losing out in that. It's the weakest, isn't it? The weakest at the end of life, the weakest at the beginning of life. But they are argued for using Christian-sounding arguments, compassionate arguments. But those are not compassionate things. In each of those, there are humongous amounts of compassionate things we can do, and each individual case might be quite complicated, and we need to tread carefully. But at the end of life, the compassionate thing to do is to invest time and energy into caring for people well, even when they take up quite a lot of time and effort. Is to invest energies into the best palliative care we can possibly achieve as a society. At the beginning of life, it looks like those who have a child they don't want, finding ways to support that woman in pregnancy, support her in birth, and she still doesn't want the child when it's born, finding someone who is willing to care for that child. The early Christians went to rubbish dumps. The challenge for us is thinking, for us, can we, with compassion, step into those causes in a way that doesn't make them a culture war, in a way that isn't about us kind of trying to win an argument, but it's about saying the compassionate thing to do is to care for the weak, not get rid of the weak. What would that look like for us? How do we respond well? Because we do need to challenge that kind of thing. That will look different for different ones of us. I'm not here to launch a campaign. But the church throughout history has shown compassion to the weakest. I wonder what that might look like for us. There's much in our society we can praise. There is stuff in our society we must challenge. We're going to go into discussion groups now. Here's the question. How can we speak of God's compassion in a way that both connects with and corrects our culture's thinking? Part of the aim of this series is to equip us in conversations. Every single person we're going to be speaking to cares about compassion. What does it look like to speak of God's compassion in a way that both connects with where they're at and maybe corrects their thinking? Discuss that for 5 or 6 minutes.